From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Ravi Coltrane, saxophonist and son of John Coltrane. He makes his debut as a band leader on the new CD, Moving Pictures. Ravi was only 2 when his father died. It wasn't until he was an adult that his father's work inspired him to be a musician. Also, we talk with Mampila Rampili. She's now president of the University of Cape Town in South Africa. During the 1970s, she was a student activist, member of the Black Consciousness Movement, and colleague and lover of Stephen Biko. She has a new memoir. And Milo Miles reviews a new History of Rap CD for non-rap fans. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is cautiously responding to reports that the Middle East peace talks might be back on track. His comments came ahead of Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's meeting with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. NPR's John Itzty reports from London.
In a news conference in London following a summit with European Union leaders, President Clinton was asked about reports that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had agreed to U.S. conditions for the resumption of peace talks. Mr. Clinton declined to characterize Netanyahu's position, saying it might jeopardize prospects of an agreement. He did say the parties are working hard.
In my judgment, they have been working in earnest, good faith. And we have our hopes, but I think it is important not to raise false hopes or to characterize the talks at this time. They're just in a period when anything we say publicly will increase the chances that we will fail.
Mr. Clinton said when it turns out there's something to say, he'll be the first to the microphone. John Itzty, NPR News, London.
Leading Indonesian lawmakers are calling on President Suharto to resign. The Speaker of the Indonesian Upper House of Parliament says 4 factions will meet tomorrow to officially ask the president to step down for the integrity and unity of the country. Indonesia has been the scene of violent riots over the sudden increased costs of goods like bread and fuel. At least 500 people have been killed in the unrest. Many protesters called for Suharto's ouster. A new drug made by California biotech company Genentech shows promise in treating some women with breast cancer. The results were announced at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting in Los Angeles. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
Some human breast cancer cells make too much of a gene called HER2-NU. While this excess gene may cause the tumors to grow, it may also be their undoing. Scientists have been able to design molecules called antibodies that specifically target cells with excess HER2-NU. One of these is called Herceptin. In studies of nearly 500 women with advanced breast cancer, Herceptin was able to significantly decrease tumor size in women whose tumors have excess amounts of the HER2-NU gene. It's not clear yet whether this improvement will lead to increased survival time, but initial results suggest it may. Only about 30% of women have breast cancers that have excess HER2-NU. Scientists are now designing studies to see if Herceptin will be valuable in treating women at an earlier stage of breast cancer. Genentech has applied to the Food and Drug Administration for expedited approval of Herceptin. Joe Palca, NPR News, Los Angeles.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 35.5 points to 9,060. Its trading is moderate. NASDAQ is off 9.5 at 1837. This is NPR. In NPR's business update on Wall Street today, it's fear of what the Federal Reserve may do with interest rates, more bad news for software maker Microsoft, and the usual assortment of Monday mergers that are garnering all the attention today. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Stocks have been more or less treading water today, moving variously into positive and negative territory as the markets brace for tomorrow's scheduled meeting by members of the powerful Federal Reserve Board. That group meets here in Washington to consider whether to take any action on interest rates. Also, lots of attention being focused on Microsoft, the object of antitrust suits on the part of federal and state regulators. Microsoft stock is down $3 a share at midday. Also moving the markets today, news from Office Depot. It is gobbling up rival Viking Office products. The $3 billion stock swap deal will create a huge office supply chain. Office Depot already has more than 600 stores. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
And this just in, the Justice Department and 20 state attorneys general are suing Microsoft. They are charging anti-competitive action on the computer software maker's part to protect and extend its monopoly over computing software. The International Whaling Commission is discussing whether to again allow commercial whaling. Commission member states are meeting in Oman this week. Commercial whaling was banned around the world in 1986, but traditional hunters who sought whales just to survive were allowed to continue. Nations that want to resume whaling say now that some types of whales are so plentiful they can be hunted for profit. 6 of the world's 11 species of whale are classified as either endangered or vulnerable. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Saxophonist Ravi Coltrane bears one of the most significant names in jazz. His father was John Coltrane. His mother is jazz pianist Alice Coltrane, who named her son after Ravi Shankar. Now Ravi Coltrane is coming into his own as a musician. He's played with such artists as Roy Hargrove, Charlie Hayden, Kenny Barron, and Elvin Jones, who for many years was a member of the John Coltrane Quartet. Ravi Coltrane spoke recently with Terry Gross. His new CD, Moving Pictures, is his first recording as a leader.
Ravi Coltrane, this is your first album as a leader. Would you share with us some of the thinking behind the CD, what you wanted to communicate through the choice of compositions, sidemen, etc.? What you wanted the CD to say about your arrival as a leader?
Well, I felt this with this record, I didn't feel like I was a new artist, really. You know, I felt that I kind of was around enough for maybe some people to kind of get used to the direction I've been going in and some of the types of associations I've had over the years. And I felt that with a lot of debut records, there's this a tendency to always kind of have everything out there, your whole, everything you have to offer. And sometimes that makes for a nice record. And most of the times I don't always... you know, I didn't want to make a record like that, you know, where you do a little of this and a little of that and a little of this and to try to give the whole story in the first record. I think that with this one, I wanted it to be kind of understated, I guess, and kind of not telling the whole story, but maybe just part of the story.
You play tenor and soprano, same instruments as your father. Did you intend it that way?
No. Nothing, there was no real design at all. There was no pre-plan in how I came about into to dealing with jazz music or dealing with the saxophones or dealing with tenor and soprano specifically. It happened in a way that was pretty natural, you know, and
And what was that way?
Well, I got really caught up in music. You know, as I got older, I started hearing my father's music in a way that I hadn't really heard as a younger person, and you know, from that it allowed me to listen to other players like Charlie Parker and Sonny Rollins. I always name those two because they were real early listening experiences that I had that were really meaningful. I've heard the music all my life, but it really didn't affect me until I got older. I wasn't thinking about jazz as a young person. You know, I spent more time listening to the things that we always listen to, you know, Kool and the Gang and Earth, Wind and Fire and, you know, the Jackson 5 and James Brown. You know, I mean, really, you know, my early years of listening to music. Later on, I started listening to, you know, the Beatles and things like that, and a lot of classical music and things. And the jazz, it was fun, but it hadn't made a real impact, you know, beyond just it being a fun music.
I know you never really knew your father. I think he died before you were two.
Yeah, he died in 67. I was born in 65.
So, but you knew of him through his music. Did you, when you were young, did you investigate his life at all? Did you feel this kind of emotional desire to know more about the man who was your father?
Well, I've always had a sense of who he was as a person from, you know, things I've been told, you know, by my family, you know. So that aspect was, you know, I never felt a complete void there. You know, there was always, you know, there was always that I could... that I could have and hold on to, you know. As far as the musical history, that was something that I had to do myself, and it didn't happen until I got older, you know.
How old were you when you realized how your father was revered, and it really went beyond admired into revered? And what impact did it have on you to get a sense of that?
As I got older, I started to become more aware that he was. You know, his impact was greater than, you know, the things that I had seen as a younger person, you know, and those things were just within our kind of household, I guess, you know, and I was a real admirer of my mom. You know, she raised me, and I, you know, had opportunities to go into the studio with her and travel with her, so I always knew that there was a kind of thing, you know, for her and my father, obviously, but as, you know, as I got out on my own, I could see how my father's music was, you know, it seemed to have been influencing a lot of people, you know, people that I hadn't, you know, even imagined that it might influence.
Ravi Coltrane is my guest, and he has his first CD as a leader. It's called Moving Pictures, and it features him on tenor and soprano saxophone. In fact, why don't we pause here to listen to a track that features you on soprano saxophone.
Okay.
Why don't we hear In Three for Thee? Do you want to say something about this before we hear it?
Well, just briefly, it's an older tune. Most of the compositions on the record, I guess, maybe came about in the last year or so. But this tune, I think I wrote when I was still in college, and it was written for my niece before she was born.
Okay.
So that's the story there.
Well, I should also ask you this. How did you start to play soprano?
The soprano came first, actually. I was, you know, I played the clarinet in junior high and high school, and my mother bought me a soprano when I was 16, and it was her only real kind of overt sort of push into, you know, why don't you check this out?
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of my life, she never said, you should check this out, or you should play jazz, or you should do this, or, you know, she never pushed any kind of music on us or anything, really. You know, when we had a desire for something, she would support it, you know. So when I played the clarinet, she kind of made sure I had a nice instrument and I got private lessons and things like that. And but the soprano was, I think, her kind of way of saying, well, you know, maybe it's time to you know, check this out if you like. And so that was the first instrument, really, that I played, of the saxophones.
You know. Uh-huh. Okay, well, let's hear In Three for Thee from Ravi Coltrane's new CD, Moving Pictures. Thank you. That's Ravi Coltrane on soprano saxophone from his new CD, Moving Pictures. And it's his first CD as a leader.
And maybe the last. No, just kidding.
You don't mean that. Now, I know you had an older brother, John Coltrane Jr., who died in a car accident, I believe, in 1982. How old was he at the time of his death?
He was 17. Mm-hmm. He was 17, just shy of 18.
What happened?
It was a very unfortunate accident, you know. He had been hanging out with some friends, you know, and you know, you're at that age where you know it's cool to be hanging out later and later each night, and you know, drinking beer and things like that. It's this new thing, and he felt that he couldn't drive himself, so he let his friend drive, you know, and his friend was even more, you know, out of it than my brother was at this time, and his friend fell asleep at the wheel, and they, you know, they ran into a row of parked cars. And you know, it was a real wake-up call, you know, a real wake-up call for all of us, you know.
Did it make you any more careful or careless in your life?
You know, it made me think a lot more about you know, what we're supposed to be doing while we're here, I guess, you know. You know, it was I think the break from childhood, I guess, you know, like you know, I'd after he passed, everything kind of stopped for me, and you know, I took about 4 years where I didn't do anything. I didn't play any instruments or any music, or you know, and just kind of thought about you know, trying to find some direction, I guess, you know, trying to find something. And
why did you stop playing? Did that seem like a frivolous direction and one that you should give up in the light of this you know, tragedy in your family?
Everything shut down, you know. Everything shut down. You know, there was no choice or any conscious thought about it. Everything shut down, you know. And, you know, I took the test to leave school a year early. I just, you know, it was unbelievable, you know. It was too hard to function, you know, doing anything at that time. You know, and it took me a while. It took me until about 19... he passed in the summer 82, and it took me about till 85, 86 to really get it together again, you know, to really to try to start up again. And I don't just mean music. I mean, you know, just as a person, I guess, you know.
It's a really treacherous period to be shut down in. Those are such formative years.
Most definitely. You know, a lot of my friends were going off to college, and I was still, you know, trying to figure out what I was going to do, and you know, and just kind of floating, I call it. You know, I was, you know, letting time go by. And, you know, at this time I started playing my father's records to kind of get, you know, that history thing with him that I hadn't really had, you know, didn't really have a solid grasp on that, you know, growing up. I wanted to have, like, a deeper knowledge of his thing, you know. And that's, you know, when the music started speaking to me. You know, I think that, you know, I never realized it until this year when I started doing these interviews and talking about, you know, these things so much I think that's how it kind of happened for me, you know, that there was a real void in my life, and that the music, it had another effect on me at this point. You know, there was something in the sound of it, you know, my father's music. There was like a calling that I hadn't heard before, you know. It was something that, I don't know.
So how did you decide to start playing it more seriously yourself?
It was, that part was not the plan part, you know. I wanted, I was getting so involved as a listener and really enjoying the music on, you know, this other level that I wanted to see if it was something that I could do as a player, you know. And, you know, I had never really had any training in improvising or studied any type of jazz music before. And I just wanted to go to school to see if it was something that I, you know, might have any ability, you know, in or any desire to do, really. You know, I was really enjoying the music as a listener, and I wanted to see if, you know, if playing could be, you know, in there.
Is this when you started studying with Charlie Hayden at the California Institute of the Arts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That must have been interesting for you because, I mean, Charlie Hayden is, one of the, greatest jazz bass players, and surely he knows your father's music.
Mm-hmm.
And was it intimidating to study with Charlie Hayden and feeling that, I don't know how old you were then, but...
I was 21.
It was just considered kind of old. Start studying seriously.
Most definitely. And I think, I wish that I could have been involved in doing this earlier and earlier, but, my life developed the way it did, and I fortunately got involved when I did.
Saxophonist Ravi Coltrane is Terry's guest. His new CD is Moving Pictures. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back now to Terry's interview with saxophonist Ravi Coltrane.
I think a problem for anyone who starts playing seriously or starts playing at all when they're a little bit older is that your ability to hear go so far beyond your ability to play. And mm-hmm. for some people, that's paralyzing. Did you feel at that point when you started seriously playing that you were a much more sophisticated listener than you were a player? And did that ever trouble you or cripple you?
Well, considering I couldn't play at all when I started school, I was young as a listener too. Really, there were things I hadn't. There was a lot of music that I hadn't heard. There's a lot of music today that I'm still trying to get to. There's so much great music in the world,
mm-hmm.
and working with Charlie, when I started there, like I said, I couldn't play at all. But my mother has this association with Charlie that goes way back, and I felt comfortable around him in that sense because I'd met him before on several occasions. But musically, I was kind of thrown into situations that I was definitely not ready for because of who I was, that made it a little trickier for me.
When you started listening more seriously to your father's records, did it help give you clues about him as a person?
I feel that as my ears have changed and as I've grown as a musician, I've started to hear, I guess, more of a depth, I guess, in what was happening musically in the quartet and my father's writing and his improvisations, even especially in the later periods. I feel there's a thread really that runs through all of his work, even up until 66 and 67, that goes way back to him playing with Monk and Miles, and even in R&B groups and things with Dizzy, that right there shows you the kind of long-range thinking, the kind of focus where you don't always know where you're going, but you know that you are headed in a direction, you can hear that dedication. It's very, very clear.
I'm wondering if there are any people who come to your concerts who are also, great admirers of your father's and, devoted fans of his work, and if they project anything onto you, and if they want to use you to get at his memory in any way. Do you know what I mean? Of being somebody who other people project things onto.
Right. I think people are, nostalgia is kind of, I don't know how I feel about that, but people say, oh, you're filling his shoes or you're carrying his torch. And I don't see it like that. I'm extremely influenced by him, and this person is not only a my father, but somebody I have, this great, great respect for, And I want to, you know, I want to use his influence in a way that's not just about copying his licks, as we say. There's other ways to deal with a person's influence, and I'm trying to find those ways. You know, not only with John Coltrane's music, but with, you know, with all the music that I like. You know, and I'm trying to put that across in the things that I do, you know, like with this record and just how I present myself on gigs or as a sideman or wherever. You know, I think I'm trying to say that I understand you, you know, and I understand that you might want these things or see these things and you want me to be these things for you, but I'm trying to do something different. And maybe if you get past that thing, you know, maybe, you know, what I'm doing will be okay for you.
Well, Ravi Coltrane, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you.
Ravi Coltrane spoke recently with Terry Gross. He performs at New York's Town Hall on June 14th. He'll be playing with his mother, Alice Coltrane. Ravi Shankar will also perform in the program. The concert is billed an evening of Ravi's. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a new memoir about fighting for racial equality in South Africa during the 1960s and 70s. We talk with Mampila Rampili. She was a member of the Black Consciousness Movement and colleague and lover of Stephen Biko. And Milo Miles reviews Curtis Blow's History of Rap. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Mampila Rampili is known in her native South Africa as a feminist role model of both the apartheid and post-apartheid eras. She was among the first women to get a medical degree in her country. As an activist against apartheid in the 70s, she was banished to a remote village where she built self-help clinics that still thrive today. As an academic, she became one of South Africa's foremost anthropologists of rural poverty. In 1996, Mampila Rampili was named president of the University of Cape Town, making her the first Black African woman to head a university in South Africa. Rampili is also a single mother of two children, one of whom bears the name of her longtime lover, the political activist Stephen Biko. Biko was murdered in detention in 1977 by South African police. He was the founder of the Black Consciousness Movement, which was dedicated to ending racial oppression. In her new memoir, Across Boundaries, Mampila Rampili describes her relationship with Stephen Biko and the philosophy of Black consciousness.
It was really quite an interesting movement that focused on an analysis of how does it happen that the majority in South Africa, which is Black, can actually be kept down so effectively and efficiently by a minority. And it's in understanding that and being influenced by the wave of student protests, which started in France and in this country as well, that we began to raise the question as young people and as young Black people about what would really make a difference. And there was also the wave of the Black Power movement in this country and the Negritude movement in Africa, particularly in West Africa. And that really opened our minds to understanding that oppression had two elements to it. There was the physical oppression of a big, mighty state that keeps you in your place. But there was also the equally powerful psychological oppression, which really became embedded in one. And if one didn't believe in oneself, if one believed that, in fact, being treated as an inferior person made you inferior, and if you believed in that inferiority, then there was no chance of actually ever freeing oneself from oppression. So the focus of the Black Consciousness Movement was in liberating Black people from the psychological oppression of feeling inferior.
And how did people respond to you? Did they want their consciousnesses raised?
Well, at the beginning, people were very frightened because you must remember that this was in the late 60s, early 70s, after the massive clampdown by the South African government on the ANC and the PAC. And people were absolutely terrified of being seen to be involved in anything political. And so the impact of the Black Consciousness Movement was very slow in coming. But when it did, because it spoke to what people really cared about, which is themselves, their own self-image, then you had that surge of energy that was largely amongst the youth, but also permeated into the adult world in the form of non-governmental organizations, church groups, and you had people raising their fists for the first time and saying, if we unite, we will be able to overcome the oppression that keeps us down.
You worked closely with Stephen Biko at this time. He was married to someone else. You had married someone else, and then your marriage had fallen apart. You were divorced. You became pregnant with Stephen Biko's child. Had you planned the pregnancy?
Not really, but it's one of those things that happened subconsciously, that you want it, you don't want it. Because not wanting to be controversial, because it's very complicated to have a married man's child. But being so deeply in love, you do want to share something larger than just the two of you. So yes and no, it was planned and unplanned.
The baby died, I think, was she just over 2 months old?
Mm-hmm.
What did she die of?
Pneumonia. Viral pneumonia, which was very sad for me. But it's one of those things that also reflects the poor health services in the rural areas, because the baby was left with my mum, And it was very difficult for my mother to get the child to a hospital. And when they finally got there, there wasn't a pediatrician. There wasn't anybody other than a nurse. And so there was really no chance for the baby.
It's so painful to lose a child, especially so young. I'm thinking your relationship was such a, it was still a secret then. Did you have to grieve alone in secret?
It wasn't secret. I mean, the point is that our relationship was a public secret, if you see what I mean. Everybody knew about it, including his partner or his wife. Because it was something that really was beyond our power to keep under control, because I had, by marrying somebody else, actually tried to deny the depth of that relationship. And when it became quite... In fact, the reason why my marriage broke down is because my husband could never trust that I wasn't in love with this man anymore. So it was really a relationship which... had a momentum of its own, and I don't think that it was unstoppable. I don't think it could have been stopped in an interesting way.
After the Soweto riots in 1976, there was a police crackdown on activists. How did you first feel the crackdown?
It first occurred around one's friends getting detained, and in fact, a very close member of our community was killed in detention, Mabetla Mohapi. And I had the unenviable task of attending his postmortem. It was, in fact, on the night of our planning to go to his funeral the following day that I was detained. And so the whole wave of detention without trial was increased from August 1976 until the end of that year. But I was fortunate to be detained not for interrogation, but for what they call preventive detention.
What does that mean?
That meant that you were simply made, as my kids would say, chill out in jail. You had no contact with the outside world except the monitored visits. And you sat there until it pleased them to release you.
I believe your brother, who was only 14, was also arrested at the time. Were they trying to get at you through your brother or get at Stephen Biko through your family?
They were trying to get at Stephen Biko because they beat those little boys to smithereens to the point where they were so swollen that they couldn't get into their pants. And the whole purpose was to try and find out from them who Steve Biko sees and whether or not he's involved in activities which were proscribed in terms of his banning order.
My guest is Dr. Mampila Rampili. She is the president of the University of Cape Town and the first black woman to head a university in South Africa. Mampila Rampili is a physician and an anthropologist. She was a longtime healthcare and political activist against apartheid. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Mampila Rampili. She's the president of the University of Cape Town. She worked as an activist with the Black Consciousness Movement led by Stephen Biko during apartheid. You were arrested again shortly after you were detained for a short time. You were banned to the Northern Transvaal. Did you know the area of the country where you were going?
Not at all. But when I got to this place, I was put up in a hospital because through some twisted logic, they actually thought that I would accept a job as a medical doctor in this remote village hospital. Unfortunately, the person who received me at the hospital was a schoolmate of mine, And so she helped me to contact the Catholic Church the following day and got the Catholic priest to put me in contact with Steve. And so when I finally got through to him, I just cried. I was just so frustrated and angry. But that's the old South Africa.
Now, in the rush to banish you, the police and the authorities apparently didn't dot all their I's, and a lawyer got you back home on a technicality, only to have you banished back to the Transvaal shortly thereafter. Did you know by the time you got get back to your banishment that you were pregnant again with Stephen Biko's child?
No, I didn't know until I think that was in April, and I only got to know that I was pregnant late in May, early June. Because in the manner in which I left King Williamstown, there was no time for me to take my pills, which I was using at the time, because we had planned not to have another child until he had sorted out his marriage. And so we didn't want to raise any further eyebrows by having another child. But because I'd left in a rush, going back to King Williamstown 10 days later, it was inevitable that with the passion, there would be a product. And thank God that there was.
You were in the hospital with problems with the pregnancy when Stephen Biko was arrested again and underwent the interrogation which ended his life in 1977. Did you know how he died?
I knew exactly. I mean, after I calmed down and heard that he had died in detention, I knew that they would have tried to humiliate him and he wouldn't let them, and that they would all try to pin him down. And in the process, they would hurt him. I knew. So I don't have to go through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to know how he died. I knew exactly how he died.
What did you tell your son early
on?
Well,
it took me 4 years to tell him that actually his father is dead. And it's funny with children, because I'm sure he knew that something was wrong. So the minute I told him, he said, "Ach, shame, Mom," and gave me a big hug and ran off to go and play. It must have been a moment of relief for him. And we are very close. And he has gone through life, obviously, very deprived, not having a father. But we have an open relationship that we talk through these issues.
My guest is Dr. Mampila Rampili. She's the president of the University of Cape Town and the first black woman to head a university in South Africa. She was a longtime healthcare and political activist against apartheid and in the post-apartheid period. When your banishment was lifted in 1983, you went back to the Cape, and you lived in Cape Town during really, to put it mildly, chaotic times. How did the high crime rate, the chaos, and the political unrest intrude on your family? What was life like in the 80s there?
It was truly one of the darkest hours of South Africa, because not only was one contending with the harassment by police and the brutality of their methods and the fact that they had their armored cars parked outside of the house which we were renting. And any time you could have a burst of fire going either directed at fleeing youths, or in one instance, they actually blew a huge hole through the roof, and we only noticed it when it rained and water just started pouring down. But also one had to contend with youth that were intimidating people. And that behaved, youth who behaved in the most dreadful way. And so one was caught between the brutal police and the equally ill-disciplined youth. It was a terrible time, because what worried me most was how out of that chaos we were going to be able to build a society that would have any measure of discipline, any measure of a sense of respect for itself and for other people.
You wrote a book at the time for UNICEF called Children on the Frontline about how South African children are affected by the violence on both sides of the apartheid line. And you were criticized for your analysis of Black South Africans' violence and how it's shaping these children's lives. What did the Black activist community object to in your analysis of children in violence?
Well, they objected to the fact that I was saying, even though the system is brutal, even though the police are brutal, there is no excuse for us as Black people turning the anger against the self and letting young people be the executioners and having young people actually humiliate their parents and adults. Because my concern, as I said to them, was that in the end, we are going to have to live with these young people in the post-apartheid South Africa, and they are not going to be able to know what is right and what is wrong. And so the criticism was that I was blaming the victim. And I said, if we treat ourselves as victims, we will be victims. We've got to go beyond just simply being survivors of a bad system, but also historical agents, so that our liberation process must also have within it the seeds of the new South Africa.
You describe a great irony about your life at that time, which is that in all of this chaos, when you'd go to work, your life was very calm and peaceful and normal. Is that how you explain to yourself how many South Africans and white South Africans came to believe that there wasn't so much wrong with society under apartheid? If you never see the Black townships, then how do you know?
Absolutely. And sadly, that not wanting to know continues to date, because white South Africa and increasingly the upper and middle class Black people who have moved into the suburbs, you can literally live in Cape Town, in Camps Bay, and see nothing but the beauty of the sunsets and the sunrises and the beauty of the forest, the mountain, and not have to deal with the fact that the school system in Guguletu and Nyanga and all the Black townships is in a state of chaos. You don't have to deal with that. And this is the real success of apartheid. It has successfully created a division or divisions that insulate those who have from the have-nots. And so if we are not very careful in South Africa, we will have class replacing race as a definer of opportunities. But even having said that, the majority of poor people will be Black people. And so we really do need to constantly remind ourselves that the leafy suburbs of Cape Town are just 10 kilometers away from the dust and the chaos and the crime-ridden Guguletus of this day.
Dr. Rompili, do you still see in your work with young people as president of the University of Cape Town a Black consciousness problem in South Africa, that's the legacy of apartheid, that Blacks and young Blacks still believe that they are truly inferior, still believe the line they were fed?
Indeed. And that's part of the criticism that I get from a lot of white people. It's because there is, underlying that criticism, a belief that if something is not white and male, it must be substandard. And so I have to be very clear that our vision as a university to be a world-class African university is a conscious decision, which is not a kind of media hype, but that we know that there are elements within the university which are world-class, but there are others that are not up to scratch, and we're going to attend to that. And so I turn around to the Black students and say to them, for as long as they believe they're inferior, they're not going to take ownership of a university like Cape Town. They're going to constantly react negatively for their own benefit to this underlying white racism, which still exists in South Africa. So I have to work very closely with young black students, particularly the student leadership, to ask them and to encourage them to really examine their own consciences. Because if they liberate themselves from that inferiority complex inside, then it becomes less easy for the bigotry, whether it be racism or sexism, to get at them. And I believe that in the country as a whole, there is still a big job to be done. Because how do you explain to young black people why the poorest people, the less educated, the least educated people, the people who are entangled in the most violence and the most crime are black people? Unless, you know, there is an explanation to them that places that whole analysis in context, they're going to run the risk of believing that there's something wrong with black people.
Mampila Rampili is the president of the University of Cape Town. Her memoir is Across Boundaries. Coming up, the roots of rap. This is Fresh Air. What we know today as rap had its roots in the South Bronx of the 1970s. Back then, rap was known as hip-hop, and rappers were called MCs. Curtis Blow, who's been a DJ and a rapper and scored a rap hit in 1980 with The Breaks, has compiled a series of three CDs on the history of rap. Music critic Milo Miles reviews Volume 1.
Despite the title, Curtis Blow presents the history of rap, Volume 1. This album has only one rap on it. And that rap, Fatback's King Tim III, personality jock, is simply a fast-talking spiel over a rhythm, in the classic manner of dance DJs since the 50s. The lead-off cut is the James Brown we heard a moment ago, and that's no surprise. Some other tracks are fairly well known, but not in this context. This next number was not a hit for the Isley Brothers, though it came out in 1970 when they were on a roll. If you want to get into something, you pick the right time. Come on and follow me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you want to get into something, you chose the right time. Come on and follow me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you're disappointed with the way things are, if the reach is too short, what the DJs and rappers liked, though, was this part of the song. Hey! This spare but very tough and extended break was perfect to rap over, and every track here has some knockout spot for bare beats. Some tracks are one-hit wonders, like Scorpio by Dennis Coffey. Others are lesser-known tunes by unlikely stars, such as Hum Along and Dance by the Jackson 5. Others are straight rap cult items, like Apache by Michael Vimer's incredible bongo band. Oddly enough, this is a profoundly ear-opening set of songs, completely aside from the rap breaks. What brings all these items together are singularly rugged grooves and compact, punchy sound. As Blow says in his lively, detailed liner notes, this music was the soundtrack for the defiant kids who wanted to dance but didn't want to do disco. This is the original punk funk, and this collection lets you hear how the sharp ears of the DJs scoured for beats and breaks that fit together like steel plates. Curtis Blow presents the History of Rap, Volume 1, is the fresh collection your retro dance party needs. It's a complete alternate view of dancing in the 70s.
Milo Miles is music features editor of Soundstone.com. He reviewed Curtis Blow Presents the History of Rap Volume 1 on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.